And we're going to start down 1 Samuel chapter 14, down in verse 47. So when Saul had taken the kingship over Israel, he fought against all his enemies on every side, against Moab, against the Ammonites, against Edom, against the kings of Zobah, and against the Philistines. Wherever he turned, he routed them. And he did valiantly and struck the Amalekites and delivered Israel out of the hands of those who plundered them. Now the sons of Saul were Jonathan, Ishvi, and Malki-Shua. And the names of his two daughters were these. The name of the firstborn was Merab, and the name of the younger Michal. And the name of Saul's wife was Ahinoam, the daughter of Ahimaaz. And the name of the commander of his army was Abner, the son of Ner, Saul's uncle. Kish was the father of Saul, and Ner, the father of Abner, was the son of Abiel. There was hard fighting against the Philistines all the days of Saul, and when Saul saw any strong man or any valiant man, he attached him to himself. And you can be seated. So whenever I'm thinking through about how to divide up a chapter, there's always a question of how far do we go, how much material do we cover, how much ground do we cover. As I looked at this section, I was thinking about how to tie it in with chapter 15, and I was thinking, man, you know, we could just kind of buzz through here and then get to chapter 15. I'm like, buzz through here? Like, this is a gold mine. If you don't know your Old Testament history, like, this whole section that we just read, you might just kind of shrug your shoulders and go, nah, I don't really know what to do with that. I don't know how that applies to me, that sort of thing. But if you do know it, if you do know the history, if you do know the geography, then the Bible starts to come alive for you a little bit. And so what I wanted to do is I wanted to stop and just take some time and talk about who these people are and what their history is and why they're listed for us. And then maybe that will help us understand a little bit more about what's going on in Israel about this time. A lot of times, I think if we're honest, especially when we're reading through the Old Testament, maybe the New Testament as well, when we come across a city or people or whatever, we just kind of push on through and keep going and think, yeah, that's nice, keep moving on. But a lot of times it is good to slow down. I think it was 3 or 4 years ago, I was reading through the book of Joshua with my son Zach, and about halfway through the book of Joshua, like the fun conquering stories stop, and then it's basically just a big geography lesson for about a third of the rest of the book. And it's the tribal allotments of all of the different tribes. And you think, man, that is some rich devotional material right there. Like, whose cities are connected to what cities and that sort of thing. Well, two things I realized about that. Number one, you know, in the back of your Bible, you have maps. You can't always trust the maps because fallible people put those maps together. And they don't always follow the city distinctions that the Bible itself gives. So what we can trust is actually the Bible. We don't trust other people's take on that. So that was one. It was interesting. So what we did is we slowed down with Joshua, and we got a map, and then we just started reading through the tribal allotment, and we just started playing connect the dots. Where do we go? Where are these tribal allotments? And so that was pretty interesting. The second thing that was fascinating, blew my mind, been a Christian for 18 years, and I didn't realize that Jerusalem is actually not of the tribe of Judah. Maybe that's not a big revelation for you. That was a big revelation for me. Jerusalem is typically, in the Old Testament, considered the capital of the country of Judah. But it's actually of the tribe of Benjamin. It's in Benjamin's allotment. It's within Benjamin's borders. And so it seems like over time, Judah just sort of grafted Jerusalem in. And I thought, oh, well, that's interesting. I never knew that there was probably some sort of a connection or a treaty between Benjamin and Judah whereby Judah ended up inheriting Jerusalem. Again, that probably doesn't change your life, but it might change how you read the Bible and how the tribes relate to one another and who owns what kind of property. So I think probably what's going to happen this morning is some of you are going to find this riveting and fascinating, and other of you, there's coffee in the back. So I want to also make this a little bit interactive as well. So I put together a little bit of a map, and we'll kind of build out the map as we go. We're going to divide this this into three sections. The first is Saul's enemies. That's going to take up about 80% of our time. Then Saul's family, which will take up about 15% of our time. And then by the time we get to Saul's strategy, we'll just spend a minute or two on that. But the first thing I wanted to cover here are Saul's enemies, which are really Israel's enemies. But we want to understand who they are. So look at verses 47 and 48. So it says, when Saul had taken the kingship over Israel, he fought against all his enemies on every side, against Moab, against the Ammonites, against Edom, against the kings of Zobah, and against the Philistines. Wherever he turned, he routed them, he destroyed them. And he did valiantly and struck the Amalekites and delivered Israel out of the hands of those who plundered them. And so the question is, who are these people? Who's Edom? Who are the Amalekites? Who's Zobah and Ammon and all of these? These are names you have no doubt come across over and over again in your reading of the Old Testament. And you see that there is just constant battle being waged against all of these various people all throughout all of Israel's history. And so I wanted to kind of put this together for you a little bit. So turn back to the left to Deuteronomy chapter 7. Before we answer who they are, I want to sort of answer the question, why are they always fighting? Why is Israel always in battle? What's that all about? Yeah, they're their enemies. We know they're the enemies, but why are they enemies? Why are they going into the promised land purging people out of the promised land? And this is something that we need to understand, because Israel is told to go in and take the promised land and to destroy those who are in there. But it's not like the people who are in there are like, okay, come get us. No, they're going to fight back. They're going to attack. And so there's this constant tension going on. Well, why is Israel doing this? Some of these nations we see in 1 Samuel 14, others we see throughout the rest of the Old Testament. So in Deuteronomy chapter 7, look down and we see in verse 1, when the Lord your God brings you into the land that you are entering to take possession of it, that's the promised land, that's what we know as Israel, but when he brings you in and clears away many nations before you, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, seven nations more numerous and mightier than you. And when the Lord your God gives them over to you and you defeat them, then you must devote them to complete destruction. Absolutely wipe them out. It says, you shall make no covenant with them and show no mercy to them. You shall not intermarry with them, giving your daughters to their sons or taking their daughters for your sons. For they would turn away your sons from following me to serve other gods. Then the anger of the Lord would be kindled against you, and he would destroy you quickly. But thus shall you deal with them. You shall break down their altars and dash in pieces their pillars and chop down their asherim and burn their carved images with fire. So this is why Israel is in constant battle. God says, hey, look, I'm giving you a land. I'm giving you the promised land, what we know as, you know, geographically is Israel. And when you go in, you need to go in and you need to destroy them. Why does he say that? Is it a geographic reason? It's actually a spiritual reason, isn't it? Because if you go in there and you start making treaties with them and you start intermarrying with them, your hearts will go after their idols, go after their gods. It's a spiritual reason that they go in and destroy their enemies. Now, why did God make Israel his people? Why is it Israel? Big and strong? I mean, is this like the tough nation that God's going to use to punish all these other weaklings? The answer is no. Verse 6. It says, for you are a holy people, or a people holy to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you to be a people for his treasured possession out of all the peoples who are on the face of the earth. Verse 7, it was not because you are more in number than any of the other people that the Lord set his love on you and chose you, for you were the fewest of all peoples. But it is because the Lord loves you and is keeping the oath that he swore to your fathers, that the Lord has brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you from the house of slavery, from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Know therefore that the Lord your God is God, the faithful God, who keeps covenant and steadfast love with those who love him and keep his commandments to 1,000 generations and repays to their face those who hate him by destroying them. He will not be slack with the one who hates him. He will repay him to his face. You shall therefore be careful to do the commandment and the statutes and the rules that I command you today. So Israel was not the biggest and the strongest. In fact, Israel was one of the weakest. If you remember when God found them in Israel, not that he didn't know that they were there, but when they were down in Israel, they were numerous, but they were slaves. They were the weakest people on the planet, oppressed by Pharaoh, king of Egypt. They had no power. They had no even willpower to rise up and conquer Egypt. God simply chose Israel because he wanted to choose them. He set his love on them. Out of all the people on the face of the planet, God says, I chose you. I set my love on you. You're my treasured possession. I'm also keeping my promise to your forefathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob. Promise that I gave them to raise up offspring after you. And the fact that Israel was given this land is actually a testimony to God's faithfulness, a testimony to God's covenants and who he is as our God. God didn't have to give them in this sense, but he did because he loved them. And God gave Israel full possession of the land just a generation after this. They came in, they took the whole thing. God said, not one word of my promise has been slack or void. I've given you all. God loved them, and he was faithful. Now, Israel might get a little self-righteous. Yeah, we were weak, but we're better than these other people. These other people are wicked. That's why you're sending us in here. We'll look over at chapter 9, verses 4 through 7. Just in case Israel got a little self-righteous, God's going to bring him down to size a little bit. And he says in Deuteronomy 9, verse 4, do not say in your heart, after Yahweh, the Lord your God, has thrust them out before you, these enemies, don't say in your heart, it is because of my righteousness that the Lord has brought me in to possess the land. Whereas it is because of the wickedness of these nations that Yahweh is driving them out before you. Not because of your righteousness or the uprightness of your heart are you going in to possess the land, but because of the wickedness of these nations, the Lord your God is driving them out before you, and that he may confirm the word that the Lord swore to your fathers, to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob. Know, therefore, that Yahweh your God is not giving you this good land to possess because of your righteousness, for you are a stubborn people. Remember and do not forget how you provoked Yahweh your God to wrath in the wilderness. From the day you came out of the land of Egypt until you came to this place, you have been rebellious against Yahweh. So just in case there's a little self-righteousness, he's like, no, you guys are stubborn and you guys are rebellious. The only reason I'm choosing you, setting my love on you, is to keep my covenants with your fathers and to purge the land of the utter wickedness that's in there. See, a lot of times we have in our mind when Israel goes in, like, boy, why are they going after these countries? We have to understand these are not nice people that are just kind of out on the prairie, you know, hanging their laundry and singing songs kind of deal. Like, these are wicked, wicked people that burn their children in fire to Molech and to Ashtaroth. And there's sexual immorality that is rampant all throughout the land. These are deplorable, disgusting people. They're made in the image of God, but their wickedness is rampant. And God is using Israel as a vehicle of judgment against these people. Again, not because Israel is so great or righteous. They're not. They're just as rebellious. They're just as stubborn. In fact, we read in Ezekiel, sometimes they're worse. But they are God's instrument of judgment. And that's God's prerogative to do so. Israel is not more intrinsically righteous than the pagan nations. Moses, who wrote Deuteronomy, actually, if you go on to read the rest of chapter 9 here, he goes on to recount, hey, you remember when we came out of Egypt and we're sitting there at Mount Sinai and I went up on Mount Sinai to get the Ten Commandments and you guys were all down on the plain engaged in sexual immorality around a golden calf? Yeah, that was you guys. That's how righteous you are. And so he reminds them that they are wicked too, but that God in his grace has chosen them. So this is why they are always doing battle. If you ever wondered, why are they always going out to war? Why are they always battling these people? Because this is what God has commanded them to do. Go in and purge the land. Purge the land of this wickedness that's going on. Don't intermarry. You know what the first thing Israel started doing when they got in the land? They started making covenants and they started marrying. And you know what happened to Israel's heart? It started going after the Baals and the Ashtaroth and all these other gods. Exactly what God said would happen. That's why they're in constant battle. Okay, who are these nations? We saw them a little bit back in chapter 7 of Deuteronomy. We saw them in chapter 14 of 1 Samuel. Who was Moab? And who are the Ammonites? Turn over to Genesis 19 for a minute. Genesis 19. Most of us think of Genesis as being simply a history of the beginning of the world. And it very much is. We read it like a history. This is what happened. This is how God created the world. And this is how things sort of unfolded. And it very much is that. But it's not just that. For ancient Israel, it was also a history of their people. And a history of who they were related to and who these people were that were in the land. Think about this. When Israel goes down into Egypt and they're slaves to Pharaoh, they really don't know, after a while, they kind of forget their history. They don't know who they are. So when God brings them out of Egypt and is about ready to take them into the promised land, and God's talking about, hey, destroy these people and these people and these people, they're like, who are these people? And why should I destroy them? What's that all about? And what you read in Genesis, and we'll see in just a minute, is you get a little bit of the history of who these people are and where they came from, and why they are cursed. And so that's really what we're going to see. And we see this in Genesis chapter 19. So we have the Moabites. Who are the Moabites? Well, they go all the way back to the man Lot. You remember Lot? He was Abraham's nephew, and he lived in Sodom and Gomorrah for a while, maybe became one of the leaders of that city for a while. Well, Moab and Ammon come from Lot. So take a look at Genesis chapter 19, and we'll start down in verse 30. Now Lot went up out of Zoar and lived in the hills with his two daughters, for he was afraid to live in Zoar. That is right after the whole Sodom and Gomorrah get destroyed situation, right? So he's off living in isolation. He's afraid of the people around him. So he lived in a cave with his two daughters. And the firstborn said to the younger, our father is old, and there is not a man on earth to come into us after the manner of all the earth. Come, let us make our father drink wine, and we will lie with him, that we may preserve offspring from our father. So they made their father drink wine that night, and the firstborn went in and lay with her father, and he did not know that she lay down or when she arose. Verse 34, the next day the firstborn said to the younger, behold, I lay last night with my father, let us make him drink wine tonight also. Then you go in and lie with him, that we may preserve offspring from our father. So they made their father drink wine that night also. And the younger arose and lay with him, and she did not know when she lay down or when she arose. Thus both the daughters of Lot became pregnant by their father. The firstborn bore a son and called his name Moab. He is the father of the Moabites to this day. The younger also bore a son and called his name Ben-Ammi. He is the father of the Ammonites to this day. So this is pretty revolting, pretty disgusting on a lot of different levels. But it is through the wickedness of Lot's daughters that we get the Moabites and the Ammonites. This is their history. And what Moses is making very clear to us is that these people are born out of sexual immorality. That's the link he's making. And I feel it necessary just kind of do a little bit of a side note here. We need to be careful when we talk about people or around people, about those who might have been conceived in a sinful situation. The sins of somebody's parents are not passed down to the child. They may have to deal with some of the baggage of that, but the sins are not passed down. We know that all children are a blessing from God, no matter what sort of situation they were conceived in. So if you've been conceived through sinful means, that has no bearing on your being made in the image of God or your legitimacy in the family of God or anything like that. Really, if you're a believer in Christ, it really doesn't matter how you were conceived. You're God's child now. You're in the family of the King. That's your entire identity, and that's all that matters for eternity. I say all that, I think it's important, because what follows next is historical in nature. I'm not talking about what we should be doing. But even just 40 or 50 years ago in America, if you had a child that was born out of wedlock, a lot of times they were shunned. The other kids, you know, the parents wouldn't let their kids play with them. They were, they were born out of sexual immorality. And so you didn't do that. You didn't play with them, certainly didn't get together and marry them. They were illegitimate, and there were all these different tensions and that sort of thing. And that was just America 40, maybe 50 years ago. You have to understand, in Israel, back in the day, in ancient times, this was on an order of magnitude greater than that. It's not just this child and the parents, there's issues. It's the whole family line's just tainted and corrupt. Just they're all done. You just don't touch them, you don't mess with them. So again, I'm just telling you this is a historical point, right? I'm not saying this is how we treat anybody. But this is how they would have thought through this. And so here, it's not just that Lot and his daughters and their children were damaged goods, as we might say. It's that their whole family line is damaged. Their whole family line comes from sexual immorality. And that defined them forever. And that's why Moses, I don't know if you've ever noticed this, that's why Moses makes these little comments. He makes this connection in verses 37 and 38. He says, the firstborn bore a son, and he called his name Moab. He's the father of the Moabites to this day. The younger also bore a son, and he called his name Ben-Ami. Why put that in there? Well, because you need to know where the Ammonites came from. You need to know where the Moabites came from. You need to understand that these are not, they're not blessed along with Israel. No, they're actually of a cursed line. They're actually of a cursed line. Okay, so I want to show you a little map here. Does that come up? Most of you guys know this. This is kind of northern Africa, Europe, and the ancient Near East. So that little red spot is Israel, modern Israel. That's the promised land that Israel was given. It's about the size of New Jersey, or three times the size of Spokane County. It's really not all that big at all. That's what all this is about. Israel is never to nation build, by the way. Israel is to stay within their boundaries. They were never to go and collect more land. This was always it, this little sliver of land in the ancient Near East. So if you're not familiar with that area, this gives you maybe a little bit more context of where we're talking. This is the promised land. This is all that they were promised. In fact, originally, you see the body of water at the top. What's that? It's the Sea of Galilee. And then there's what river goes down? It's the Jordan River that goes down, and it connects to the Dead Sea in the south. Originally, God had just given the Israelites the stuff to the west, between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. But when the people of God got too close to the land, some of the people wanted to settle on the east side, and God said, well, I'll give that land to you as well. And so that's where we get some of the land up at the top. There are two stars. Stars represent capital cities. The bottom one is Jerusalem. That's normally what we think of being the capital city of Israel. But initially, when Israel got into the land, they camped in Shiloh, which is the top star. And so Israel's capital was kind of Shiloh for a while. That's where the tabernacle was. And only later on was it moved down to Jerusalem. So this is the promised land. This is it. This is all it is. You can draw two circles, a line between them, and a curve, and you've drawn the promised land. I mean, it's pretty simple. This is where the Ammonites and the Moabites ended up. So Moab was to the southeast of the Dead Sea. They were not technically in the land, but when Israel was coming into the land, they had to fight the Moabites. And the Moabites would often make raids into the land of Canaan, or the Promised Land. The Ammonites were actually in the land. They were part of those people that Israel was going to have to purge. So this is kind of where we see them. Okay. So that's Moab, and that's Ben-Ammi, or the Ammonites. We also read about the Amalekites and the Philistines. Who are they? Well, their history starts a little bit earlier. So turn over to Genesis chapter 9 for a minute. This is just after the flood. You remember the worldwide flood that drowned everybody except 8 people on the planet. By the way, just kind of interesting little side note. The word flood in Hebrew is actually cataclysm. That's really the word that they're describing. It's not just like the water came up. It's like cataclysmic activity. So it's a cataclysm. So God spared 8 people, Noah's wife, their 3 sons, and the wives of the 3 sons. And the sons were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And Israel comes from Shem. This is why if you are anti-Jewish, you are anti-Semitic. It's that root word, that derivative. So the Hebrews are Semites. And we have this little incident shortly after the flood. So look down, chapter 9, verses 18 through 29. The sons of Noah who went forth from the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ham was the father of Canaan. Now, real quick, where do we hear Canaan? The Promised Land is called the land of Canaan a lot of times. Verse 19, these 3 were the sons of Noah, and from these the people of the whole earth were dispersed. Noah began to be a man of the soil, and he planted a vineyard. He drank of the wine and became drunk and lay uncovered in his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his 2 brothers outside. Then Shem and Japheth took a garment, laid it on both their shoulders, and walked backward so they wouldn't see their father, and covered the nakedness of their father. Their faces were turned backward, and they did not see their father's nakedness. When Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his youngest son had done to him, he said, "Cursed be Canaan. A servant of servants shall he be to his brothers." He also said, "Blessed be Yahweh, the God of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. May God enlarge Japheth, and let him dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant." After the flood, Noah lived 350 years. All the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. Now, we really don't know what happened between Ham and Noah, his father. There's all kinds of speculation, but as mild as Ham just kind of made fun of Noah to all sorts of other ideas that people have about the situation, we don't know for sure. But what we do know is that Ham and Canaan seem to be in on it, and Noah seemed to know it. It seemed like Ham maybe led the way, but it's Canaan that Noah cursed. And so Canaan is now a cursed line. What's interesting is Noah gives this cursing and blessing proclamation in verses 25 through 27. And what you have to understand is in the Old Testament, these weren't just like holiday greeting card wishes. When somebody in the Old Testament gave a prophetic proclamation, that was kind of like how that person's life went. Remember Jacob and Esau, where Jacob steals the blessing from Esau, and Esau's like, "Are you kidding me? He steals my blessing too?" And I think most of us are like, "What's the big deal? Like, go make a life for yourself." Because this is really a prophetic outpouring of what will happen in their lives. This is what we see throughout the Old Testament. Well, here the prophetic outpouring is that Yahweh will bless Shem, you will be the God of Shem, and all the and Ham or Canaan specifically is going to be a servant. He's going to be cursed. Cursed be Canaan. So this is where we start to get the idea that, oh, those Canaanites that inhabit the land, they're actually a cursed people. And just like we saw with Moab and the Ammonites, they're cursed primarily because of some sort of sexual immorality. And we see that here as well. Again, why does Moses record this for us? It's the same reason that he recorded the incident with Lot. It's not just gee whiz information. It's to help Israel understand who are they going to go in to destroy. They're called to go into this land and they're called to wage war, but who are these people? Well, we need to understand that Canaan, but Ham also, are cursed people. They're cursed by Yahweh all the way from their inception. They were complicit in sexual immorality and being cursed by Noah. So that's Canaan. And it's really just the Canaanites, they weren't like necessarily a specific tribe. They were just sort of peppered all through the land of Israel. There was no one specific place that they were. But that's why you'll often hear that the Promised Land is interchangeably called the land of Canaan, is because these are the people that Israel was to go in and dispossess. So that was chapter 9. In chapter 10, we have what is often called the Table of Nations, because it's from these three men, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, the rest of the world comes. So all of us are either from Shem, or we're from Ham, or we're from Japheth, or some combination, or all of them. So this is where the whole world comes from. But look down in Genesis 10, starting in verse 6. Here we see the line of Ham. Remember, this is the cursed line. So the sons of Ham, Cush, Egypt, Put, and Canaan. The sons of Cush, Seba, Havilah, Sabtah, Ramah, and Sabtica. The sons of Ramah, Sheba, and Dedan. Verse 8, Cush fathered Nimrod. He was the first on earth to be a mighty man. He was a mighty hunter before Yahweh. Therefore it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before Yahweh. The beginning of his kingdom was Babel. What city was that a part of? It was Babylon. Erech, Akkad, and Calneh in the land of Shinar. Verse 11, from that land he went into Assyria and built Nineveh, Rehoboth, Ir, Kala, and Rezin between Nineveh and Kala. That is the great city. Verse 13, Egypt fathered Ludim, Anamim, Lehabim, Naphtuhim, Parthrusim, Kalsuhim, from whom the Philistines came, and Kaphtorim. So you start to see these nations that we're familiar with. Some we're not familiar with, but some we are familiar with. The Philistines. Who do they come from? They come from Ham. They come from Canaan. They're cursed people. In fact, we see all of the major enemies of Israel are from the cursed line, aren't they? So Nimrod goes up, he builds Babylon. Where were the Jews in captivity? They're in Babylon. He builds Nineveh, which is Assyria. Who hauled off half of the Jews? The Assyrians. Where were the Jews enslaved for 400 years? In Egypt. They're constantly being attacked by these people God has cursed. The cursed line of Ham and Canaan. And of course, we see the Philistines. I put a little red dash there because the Philistines actually tended to hang out there, except when Israel was in sin, the Philistines would sort of invade into the Philistine land. Or the Philistines would invade into the further into the promised land. So, we have all of these major enemies. And he gives us this history. Now, remember Ezekiel 16. Your father was an Amorite. Your mother was a Hittite. Take a look, chapter 10, verse 15. Canaan fathered Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth. Heth is the father of the Hittites, and the Jebusites, the Amorites, the Girgashites. So Heth is the father of the Hittites. So when God says to Israel, your father was an Amorite and your mother was a Hittite, he's not giving us actual genealogy. This is a slam. Can I be a little crass here? This is a your mama joke. Right? Your mama was a Hittite and your father was an Amorite. Burn. Right? That's what we're to hear. They're cursed. They're from sexual immorality. So when we're reading through Ezekiel and we read some of these things, we should be like, God's slamming them. Because they're acting like the cursed line. The people of God, the purity, is gone, and they are acting not like Shemites, not like the blessed line, but like the cursed line. That's what God is getting at. All right. The Amorites live up north by the Sea of Galilee. Actually, that's where they're primarily from. If you read through the Old Testament, you'll get the idea that there were actually Amorites all kind of trickled out all through the land of Israel, but that's primarily where they're at. Okay. They kind of moved around a little bit. Turn over to Genesis 36 for a minute. Let's take a look at a few more here. Next we have Edom. Edom are the descendants of Esau. Who is Esau? Well, if you remember, Abraham had two sons, Ishmael the cursed son and Isaac the blessed son. So just as a little side note, Muslims reinterpret history to say that actually it was Ishmael who was the blessed line and Isaac was the cursed line. But we know that it's actually the other way around. Isaac was actually blessed. But then Isaac had two sons. He had Jacob and Esau. And it was Jacob who was blessed, not Esau. Esau, all of his descendants, in fact, it's kind of interesting, Jacob had 12 sons and Esau had, I think, 12 sons as well. He had his own great line, but it was not the blessed line. So take a look down at chapter 36, verses 6 through 8. Then Esau took his wives, his sons, his daughters, and all the members of his household, his livestock, all his beasts, all his property that he had acquired in the land of Canaan. He went away into the land of his brother Jacob, from his brother Jacob, excuse me. Verse 7, for their possessions were too great for them to dwell together. The land of their sojournings could not support them because of their livestock. So Esau settled in the hill country of Seir. Esau is Edom. And actually it says Esau is Edom in, up in verse 1 as well. But this is where Esau ended up, was to the south. So he's to the south of the Dead Sea. This is the Edomites. There's also Amalek. One last group. Look down in verses 9 through 12. These are the generations of Esau, the father of the Edomites in the hill country of Seir. These are the names of Esau's sons. Eliphaz, the son of Adah, the wife of Esau. Reuel, the son of Basemath, the wife of Esau. The sons of Eliphaz were Teman, Omar, Zepho, Gatam, and Kenaz. Timnah was a concubine of Eliphaz, Esau's son. She bore Amalek to Eliphaz. These are the sons of Adah, Esau's wife. So Amalek is also of the cursed line. Amalek is of Esau. He's not of Jacob, not of Isaac. Or he is of Isaac, but not of Jacob. So he is the cursed line. Actually, what's interesting is that in Israel's history, as they were coming up out of Egypt, Amalek was so fierce and so brutal that they would make raids. You know, you got these 2 million people walking. They would make raids on the back of the group with all the women and children. They were just ruthless. And actually, as a point of Mosaic law, God said, you will utterly destroy all the Amalekites. They were that bad to your people. Like, none of the other people were like, yeah, just wipe them all out. With the Amalekites, God names them. Like, you are going to go destroy them. That is how horrific they actually are. All right, so that's a little bit of a whirlwind tour of the enemies. Let's go back to 1 Samuel 14 and kind of put this together. Verse 47, when Saul had taken the kingship over Israel, he fought against all his enemies on every side. Against Moab, against the Ammonites, against Edom, against the kings of Zobah, and against the Philistines. Wherever he turned, he routed them. He did valiantly and struck the Amalekites and delivered Israel out of the hands of those who plundered them. And just for our little last map here, Zobah is at the very top. It's actually considered outside of the promised land proper, I think. So this is all of Saul's enemies. Where are Saul's enemies? They're all over the place. They're all over the place. And I don't know if you kind of caught even how he's being described here. We've seen for weeks now, really months, what kind of a guy Saul is. And he's not a guy you want to be like. But I don't know if you caught this. He's kind of given in a decent light. Hey, he's now doing the job that God has raised him up to do, which is to fight the enemies. He's not all bad. He's pretty bad. But he's not all bad. He is doing what he was called to do. But he's fighting everywhere. He's fighting inside the promised land. He's fighting outside the promised land. He's not nation building, but he's nation defending is what he's doing. He's trying to keep these other people out of the promised land and out of raiding. Now, I want to make just two observations before we move on. First is that when we look at Saul specifically, but really anybody, and I mentioned this just a minute ago, like nobody is ever 100% bad. We believe in total depravity, not in utter depravity. So Charles Spurgeon once said, as salt is in every drop of the Atlantic, so is sin in every drop of our being. So we believe in total depravity that affects us totally. But we don't believe in utter depravity that we are 100% salt, right? Or that anybody is 100% salt. There is some common grace in everyone. Second is really what we have seen here can be very difficult for people to understand. Why is it that God gives the promised land to Israel? Well, who owns all the land? God owns all the land. God owns all the land. You and me, like the place that we live on, we're just kind of like squatters, really. I mean, this kind of is ours. Our name is associated with a deed or a lease or whatever, but we're just kind of squatters. It's really all God's land. God can give whoever he wants his own land. And God in his sovereignty chose and loved Israel and gave Israel this promised land. We can't change that. God has given it to them. Acts 17 says God made the world and everything in it. He is the Lord of heaven and earth. He gets to do what he wants with his planet. All right, number two, like I said, we're going to go quickly through these next two. Saul's family. I think this is going to be helpful. Verse 49. Now the sons of Saul were Jonathan, Ishvi, and Malki-Shua. And the names of his two daughters were these. The name of the firstborn was Merab, and the name of the younger Michal. And the name of Saul's wife was Ahinoam, the daughter of Ahimaaz. And the name of the commander of his army was Abner, the son of Ner, Saul's uncle. Kish was the father of Saul, and Ner, the father of Abner, was the son of Abiel. Now, if you guys have read 1 and 2 Samuel in the past, you get to realize that 1 and 2 Samuel kind of reads a little bit like a soap opera meets the mafia. I mean, it really does. Like, there's all these interesting connections back and forth, and people are killing each other, and there's grudges, and the grudges don't go as far as killing sometimes because they are family, and back and forth. And so it's helpful to have a little bit of an idea of just who these folks are. Jonathan, of course, we've met. He's Saul's son. He's a valiant warrior. He'll eventually become the best friend of King David. They'll be closer, David says, than even his own wife. Spoiler alert, Jonathan will also die a tragic death at the end of 1 Samuel. He'll die along with Saul and one of his other brothers. We don't know much about Ishvi or Malki-Shua. There's a chance they go by other names in other places of the Bible. So if you're reading through other places where it lists Saul's genealogy or his offspring, you'll read these other guys and you're like, well, who are they? A lot of times in the Bible, people have multiple names. Saul also has two daughters, Merab and Michal. So here's the soap opera. Turn over to chapter 18 for just a moment. This is after David is proven he's a valiant warrior. He's just killed Goliath. He's now been put into Saul's army. People are singing his praises, literally singing his praises in the street. Saul has slain his thousands. David has 10,000s. And you'd think Saul's like, man, I've got a Navy SEAL for a general. Like, this is cool. Instead, Saul is very jealous of David. But he also realizes David's really good. So he's upset with David, tries to kill him. But then he wants to make it up to David because he doesn't want to lose him, doesn't want David on his bad side. So he's like, I'll give my daughter to David in marriage. Because that's what you do when you want to kill somebody, but you don't really want to. It's nuts. So look down, 1 Samuel 18, down in verse 17. Then Saul said to David, here's my elder daughter Merab. I will give her to you for a wife. Only be valiant for me and fight the Lord's battles. For Saul thought, let not my hand be against him, but let the hand of the Philistines be against him, because he's going to kill him. Verse 18, and David said to Saul, who am I and who are my relatives, my father's clan in Israel, that I should be son-in-law to the king? But at the time when Merab, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, she was given to Adriel, the Meholathite, for a wife. Verse 20, now Saul's daughter Michal loved David, and they told Saul, and the thing pleased him. Saul thought, let me give her to him, that she may be a snare for him, and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. Therefore Saul said to David a second time, you shall now be my son-in-law. This was considered normal in the aristocracy. Just trading daughters. Like it's, well, you know, that one's whatever, we'll give you this one. This is what's going on. This is Israel's monarchy. Back in chapter 14, we also read about Abner. Abner is Saul's cousin, and he's a general. He's literally Saul's right-hand man. You'll see Abner just kind of mentioned when big decisions are made. Abner makes a mistake, though. Once Saul dies, Abner thinks that one of Saul's sons is going to become king, and Abner throws his support behind that son instead of King David. And so then there's fighting between them. And there's a point where Abner actually comes to David and says, hey, I'm going to give up. I'm going to be on your side. Will you take me in? And David says, absolutely. Problem is Abner killed somebody important's brother, and he gets murdered too. So it's, yeah, mafia meets soap opera, and that's Israel's history. Last part. Verse 52, we see Saul's strategy. And we've seen this all along. This is what a king is going to do to you. And Saul fulfills all that was written. There was hard fighting against the Philistines all the days of Saul. And when Saul saw any strong man or any valiant man, he attached him to himself. Remember back in chapter 8, when Samuel's warning him, hey, you get a king, he's going to take your guys. He's going to take all your strong sons, all your valiant warriors, everybody, and he's going to attach them to himself. What's Saul doing? He's living that out. He's taking the people's family. He's taking their sons to defend the people. What is interesting, and just a little devotional point as I close here, what is interesting is that this section is positive for Saul. He is actually doing what he's called to do now. We'll see in the very next chapter, he'll blow it big time. But he is doing what he's called to do. Not everybody is as wicked as they could possibly be. We can't pigeonhole people into black and white or one corner or other corner. We have to understand that by God's common grace, there are times when even those who are not believers bless believers when they show us grace and show us mercy. I hope that was helpful to you. Let's pray. Father, we do thank you for your word. We thank you that we can understand your word. We can read your word and study your word in relative peace. But may we not use that peace as a means to become slack. But Lord, may we be diligent all the more to know you through it. We ask in Christ's name. Amen.